testimony?
No, we're going to finish up this. Apologetics 2, lecture number 22. We're providing evidence right now for the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch, the first five books. And let's see, I think we're on the point L on page 21. The study of ancient religions has now shown that primitive peoples had technical sacrificial language. That was one of the arguments that those who held to the documentary hypothesis put forward, was that the sacrificial language found in the priestly code was just too advanced to have been written at 1450 BC. But now we have found that ancient religions of primitive peoples did have technical sacrificial language even before that date. We also now know that writing existed during Moses' time. It's almost humorous, but when the documentary hypothesis was first being formed, it was assumed that man had not evolved enough to learn how to write at the time of Moses. Yet now we know that writing did exist, extensive writing did exist during Moses' time. For instance, 1500 BC, the Rosh Shamra literature, and I believe there was even some receipts of business transactions found that date all the way back to 3000 BC. Archaeological finds have also confirmed the Pentateuch. The city of Ur, Shechem and Bethel, the Hittite legal code, even the use of camels found in the book of Genesis during Abraham's time, that was questioned for that area of land that camels had been domesticated. Then they found that even Egyptians had domesticated camels long before that. So archaeological finds have confirmed the Pentateuch. The Code of Hammurabi, which dates back to about 1800 BC, is similar to the Mosaic laws, similar to the laws of Moses. The laws of Moses were thought to be too sophisticated and too precise to date back to 1450 BC, yet now we find other legal codes that date even before Moses wrote, and their laws were highly technical as well. The book of Numbers, where the Israelite people are numbered, they are the census that is taken, they are numbered, they are counted, and then they, due to lack of faith, refuse to go into the promised land, so they wander in the wilderness for 40 years, and then they're numbered a second time. Well, Numbers is similar to the 1800 BC Marie Text census list. So again, right in the same time frame, you have census being taken that were very similar. Deuteronomy, Mike McKenzie covered this in the class on world religions. Deuteronomy has the same format as the Hittite Suzerainty Treaty, which dates back to the latter half of the second millennium BC. It was a treaty between a king and his people, and it usually starts out with the king the recognition of the king as the king of the people, and the people accept his rule, and then the king says, "I'll bless you if you obey these rules. If you break these rules, I'll curse you," that type of thing. And it follows, the book of Deuteronomy follows the same format as this ancient Hittite suzerainty treaty. Ancient.
Isn't it also true that on that suzerainty treaty, that particular format was only in use for a very short window of time?
Yeah.
That coincides with the traditional.
Yeah, in about 300, 400, 500 year time frame, yeah. Right. And it's a small window, and it just shows that the styles. That's a good point, John, because it shows that the styles that were used in writing the first five books were those styles were being used in the small window of time when Moses lived, but these styles were not being used in the larger window of time when the liberal scholars said that this was actually written. And then when you couple that with the fact that the author of the Pentateuch gave eyewitness details of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, yet he did not give eyewitness details to the land of Canaan, when you couple that with the fact that the supposed authors, according to those who hold the documentary hypothesis, would have lived in Israel at a much later time. Some of them would have lived in Babylon or somewhere in exile. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever, because they would not have had these eyewitness details that Moses would have had had he been the traditional author, had he actually been the author of the Pentateuch. Also, the ancient legends of creation and a worldwide flood have been circulated throughout the world. So whenever we find a primitive people, we find out about their legends of creation, worldwide flood, or we do archaeological digs and we come up with the Enumis Elis or the Gilgamesh epic of the Babylonian civilization. And when you look at these legends and you compare them with the biblical account, they appear to be possible perversions. They appear to be perversions of the true biblical accounts. For instance, when you take from the Gilgamesh epic the shape of the ark that their Noah supposedly built, it was built like a cube and it would not float. Whereas when you take the dimensions of the ark built by Noah in the Bible, it has the same dimensions as modern-day barges, where the more you weigh it down, the harder it is to capsize it. And it was such an enormous size and with the perfect dimensions, so that even if there was a tremendous wave that knocked it all the way over on a 90-degree angle, it would immediately right itself. So the ancient legends of creation and worldwide flood that are throughout the world are possible perversions of the true biblical account. Also, the Jews accepted the law as Mosaic. They accepted the first five books of the Bible as being from Moses during Josiah's reform in 621 B.C. Therefore, it's hard to believe that any large portion had just been written, that these people were so gullible that they really believed that they were looking at writings that had been passed down from generation to generation for the last 1,000 years. It's hard to believe that they were so gullible that they didn't even realize that a large portion was just a forgery that had just been put together. I was talking when the other cassette cut off, but the more we study primitive peoples, the more anthropologists study primitive peoples now, the more they find that, here's the way they argued: the more primitive of a culture, you go to Africa or South America, you meet a tribe, a primitive culture that has no modern technology, and they're almost always polytheists. And so the argument used to go, therefore, polytheism is the most primitive form of religion, and it evolved into monotheism like Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. Well, now what they're starting to find, though, the more they get to know these people admit that there's a vague memory of that their ancestors used to worship the one true creator God who created all the lesser gods that they worship right now. But they forgot the name of the one true creator God. They forgot how to worship him, and so in the meantime, they use animal sacrifices to appease the lesser gods out of fear for them. Okay? So, basically, and then they even admit that there was a time when they used to offer animal sacrifices to the one true creator God. So now, many anthropologists, even evolutionary ones, are admitting that the first religion of man was the belief in one creator God and animal sacrifice to appease him, or animal sacrifices were offered to him, which is basically what you have in Abel sacrifice in the Bible. So the much of the documentary hypothesis that is still held to, the presuppositions that were behind, that were the reasons why they came up with the documentary hypothesis, well, that entire base has been removed, and so there's no reason for holding to these conclusions since the premises have been proven false. And so that basically is a refutation of the documentary hypothesis and some evidence, some positive evidence for the Mosaic authorship. Now let's take a look at the sixth book of the Old Testament, the book of Joshua. Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land was thought to be nothing but fairy tales and myths. However, we now have found the Amarna tablets, which date back to 1400 to 1350 B.C. From 1400 to 1350 B.C., and the Amarna tablets contain reports from different kings in Palestine, basically different Canaanite kings, kings from the land of Canaan, the Palestine area, reports from the kings in Palestine to Egypt requesting assistance against the Hapiru invaders. Hapiru, H-A-P-I-R-U, the Hapiru invaders. Now, what a lot of scholars like Gleason Archer have argued is that Hapiru was an ancient form of the, an ancient variation of the word Hebrews. And that when you compare these reports from the Canaanite kings asking assistance from the Egyptian pharaoh, when you compare these reports of these Hebrew and possibly Hebrew invaders, some of these reports perfectly coincide with the accounts given in the book of Joshua. Some of them, however, do not coincide. For instance, some of the mentioned cities being taken over by the Hapiru, which the Israelites did not take, or vice versa. And that problem can easily be explained by the fact that Abraham himself was a Hebrew. So if Abraham was a Hebrew, there's more Hebrews than just Israelites. In fact, one of the supposed meanings of Hebrew is people from across the river. And so the people from across the river could be more than just the Hebrews. It could be all the nomadic people, or just the Israelites. It could be all the nomadic people that had come into that area when Abraham himself came into that area. So there seems to be some good solid confirmation of Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land in the Amarna tablets. Yeah?
Would you refer to Abraham as an uncircumcised Gentile?
Would I?
Yeah,
no.
That would describe, wouldn't it?
Well, before his circumcision, he was a Hebrew from the start, but from him came the nation of Israel. I think Paul would go so far to say, and it would shock the Jews of his day in Romans 2, but Paul would go so far to say that he's the father of both the, in fact, even in Romans 4, he touches on it, that Abraham is the father of both the circumcised and the uncircumcised. All who believe in Christ, Abraham is the father of. So, in a sense, he was a Gentile. All the world were Gentiles. But God took one Gentile and said, I'm going to make a nation from you. He's going to be my chosen nation. And so this was the one Hebrew that from this one Hebrew came the Israelite nation, the chosen nation of God. And this uncircumcised man, eventually God had him circumcised. Now, Isaiah, the traditional date for Isaiah was 740 B.C. to 680 B.C. Liberal scholars hold to the Deutero-Isaiah theory, the idea that there were two authors for the book of Isaiah. One author wrote the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, And the second author wrote chapters 40 to 66, the second portion of Isaiah. Now, this is an attempt to explain away the fulfilled prophecies contained in the book of Isaiah. Okay? Refutation, 4 points. We'll give 4 points in refutation of this, of the Deuteronomy. By the way, they're up to Tritio Isaiah theory, where now there's supposedly three Isaiahs. Refutation, the author is familiar with Palestine, but not the Babylonian area, whereas if it was written at a later time, you know, the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar in 606 BC and 586 BC, he toppled Jerusalem, and in both of those times he emptied out some of the Jews and brought them to Babylon. And supposedly Isaiah is recorded after that, since Isaiah predicts the Babylonian captivity. Okay? And yet the traditional date says Isaiah completed his work more than 100 years before the Babylonian captivity, almost 100 years before it. So the author is familiar with Palestine, the land of Canaan, or the land of Israel, not Babylon. Point number two, the predictions of the Medo-Persian Empire overthrowing the Babylonian Empire are contained in the first section. Now, this occurred in 538 BC when the Medes and the Persians defeated the Babylonians, who had taken the Israelites captive 50 to 70 years before that. And they had taken the first group captive, and then the next group 20 years later. But the predictions of the Medo-Persian overthrow of Babylon are contained in the first section, which even the liberal scholars admit was written before that occurred. So even there, even if you grant the liberal scholars their premise, you still got some of Isaiah's prophecies being fulfilled. Point number three, there's a similar style in both halves of Isaiah, and which would seem to point to one author. And point number four, John chapter 12, verses 37 to 41, Jesus quotes both Isaiah 53 from the second half of Isaiah and Isaiah 6 from the first half of Isaiah, and he credits both to the author, the prophet Isaiah. So Jesus did not hold to this view of two Isaiahs. By the way, you can also find, like in Isaiah 53, a prediction of the Jewish Messiah, that he would suffer for the sins of his people, and he would take his punishment as a lamb led to the shears. And you have predictions of the coming Messiah made, you know, and even with the, even if you give the liberals the bogus datings, the date that they would want for Isaiah, you would still have to admit again that prophecy was fulfilled. Let's take a look then at the book of Daniel, and we might get out of here early today. I knew that was coming, I was just waiting. That's from reading Homer, right?
That's right.
Okay.
Great philosopher. And Bart.
Let me see.
Bart?
The book of Daniel, he's dead. Okay, the liberal view of the book of Daniel was that it was written about 165 B.C. to encourage the Israelites to resist Antiochus Epiphanes, a ruthless foreign ruler, came from a ruler that got his power from the Greek Empire when it was split four ways. And now, again, this is because the critics refused to accept predictive prophecy. And the critics attempt to date Daniel after the events already occurred. So if Daniel predicts something, if it did occur, they try to date the book of Daniel after the event occurred, because they assume It's impossible for God to reveal the future to man. Now, the conservative view, and remember, the liberal view is that the book of Daniel was written in 165 B.C. The conservative view is that the book of Daniel was completed around 530 B.C. because Daniel lived during both the Babylonian and the Medo-Persian rule over Judah. So he was a very young boy. He might have only been 10 years old when he was taken captive by the Babylonians and then lived and ended up being trained by the Babylonians and received a high position of power. And then 50 to 70 years later, the Babylonians were taken over by the Medo-Persian Empire, and they began to rule over the Jews. And Daniel lived during both of those times, so he lived to be a very elderly man. And but the book was completed by about 530 B.C., just a few years after the Medo-Persian Empire had taken over the Babylonian Empire. Now, the evidence for the traditional date of Daniel, number one, there has been archaeological confirmation of the historical characters mentioned in the book of Daniel. For instance, King Belshazzar, we found his name on cuneiform tablets. Darius the Mede, for a long time, it was questioned whether he or not he existed. Now we have gathered some information on a man named Gubaru, who may have been Darius the Mede, and Darius apparently is just a title like that of Caesar. Also, there's three Greek words found in Daniel. Now, first, the Jews ruled themselves, but then the Babylonian Empire took them captive. Then, after that, the Medes and the Persians. And then about 330 B.C., the Greeks, the Greek Empire, conquered the Medes and the Persians. So there's three Greek words found in Daniel, yet the Greeks didn't take over Palestine until 330 B.C., So the question comes up, how do these Greek words get in there? Well, the liberal scholars argue that therefore Daniel was written after 330 B.C., and it had to be in order for these Greek words to come in there. But in, as a matter of fact, though, those three Greek words are musical instruments. And so all that is required is that while Daniel was living under the Medo-Persian Empire 200 years before they were knocked off by the Greeks, some instruments invented by the Greeks had found their way through trade into the Medo-Persian Empire to where they were commonly used, and they kept their Greek names. It's just like piano. We think of piano today as an English word, but actually it's an Italian word that names an instrument. Yep. Got to throw something in about the Italians at least once per lecture.
Covering the book of Malachi.
Hey, there you go. Malachi, the Italian prophet. Okay, also Daniel uses early Aramaic. It can be shown that he used early Aramaic, which was the Hebrew of his day, which is further evidence for the early traditional dating of Daniel. Liberal scholars like to argue that Daniel's theology proves a late date because his theology was too far advanced. His view of angels, they say, was not found earlier in the Bible. His view of the resurrection and his view of the kingdom of God. But when in actuality, when you compare it with other books that are accepted as much earlier than Daniel, you do find these things taught. In fact, even in the book of Job, he talks about angels, the sons of God, presenting themselves before God's throne, and Lucifer or Satan is with them. And you find even in the book of Job, which is probably the earliest book written in the Bible, the idea of resurrection. Job says that he knew that his knows that his Redeemer lives, and at the last he would take his stand upon the earth. And he also asked the question that in his flesh would he see life again after his death. And so there was a concept of resurrection in there as well, and you will find the ideas of the kingdom of God throughout the Old Testament scriptures as well. So Daniel's theology does not prove a late date. And also, some of Daniel's predictions were fulfilled after 165 B.C. So if you've got to admit to a few fulfilled prophecies, then you might as well just, your whole premise goes out the window, and the traditional date is once again back in the picture. Now, what they will do, they will take the prophecies of Daniel, the liberal scholars, and then whenever it talks about something fulfilled in 160 after 165 B.C., they'll try to find something else that can be confused with the fulfillment before that, but it just doesn't hold water. Daniel made the prediction of the four kingdoms in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, and I'm going to give the rundown. You know, it was the four beasts. But in Daniel chapter 7, but in Daniel 2, was Nebuchadnezzar's statue. Each part of the statue stood for a different beast, or a different empire. But the Babylonian Empire took Judah captive in 586 B.C. That was followed by the Medo-Persian Empire in 538 B.C., which then ruled over Judah when they knocked off the Babylonians. Now, the three ribs in the mouth of the Medo-Persian Empire probably stand for the fact that the Medo-Persians knocked off Babylon, Egypt, and Lydia at that time. And really makes you feel bad for Lydia. No, in 330 B.C., Greece, the Greek Empire, took over, knocked off the Medo-Persian Empire, and then there was a four-way split. And this four-way split, you know, and that was because Alexander the Great, when he died, he had a son who apparently was mentally slow and was incapable of taking the kingdom from him. So then four of his generals divided the kingdom in a less than friendly manner. And you had this four-way split. Well, that was predicted with these kingdoms. You know, like Daniel would start about Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold. And then it would go on, but after you, another kingdom will arise, and then another one will arise. Well, it wasn't until 63 B.C. Now remember, the liberals date the book of Daniel at 165 B.C. It wasn't until 63 B.C. when the Roman Empire came to power, and that was predicted, the fourth beast, or waist, and then the legs, and then the 10 toes of the statue. Now, the two legs show that this fourth empire was going to be split in two and continue on for a long time, and then would end up in a 10-toe stage, which would be 10 separate nations. Now, to make a long story short, the Roman Empire has continued throughout history. But it has had, what happened was the Catholic Church merged with the Roman Empire, became the Holy Roman Empire, and then it lost a lot of its power, and then there was an East and West split. So you had the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Roman Catholic Church, but it's continuing in this two-legged form. Well, in the end, the power will return to it. The end time false government and the end time apostate church, and you will end up with the 10 toes, the stage of the 10 toes, 10 kings of 10 kingdoms in the reunified or revived Roman Empire. And but that stage, Rome coming to power, was fulfilled in 63 B.C., approximately 100 years after the liberals date the book of Daniel. So if Daniel could have predicted one event 100 years later, why couldn't he have predicted several other events? Also, some of the messianic prophecies, such as Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 to 27, Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy. Well, it's a real tough prophecy to interpret, but one thing is tremendously clear, and that is that the Messiah would be, Messiah the Prince would come, and he would be cut off or executed, and then following that would be the destruction of the temple. So since the temple was destroyed in 70 AD, whoever the Jewish Messiah was, he would be executed before the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. And of course, Jesus was executed somewhere between 30 to 33 AD. So again, Daniel predicts the death of the Messiah and the destruction of the temple, two events that occurred a lot later than 165 BC. So if Daniel had the ability and claimed he got this ability from God to predict the future, then we conclude that the evidence supports the 530 BC date of Daniel. And even with the 165 BC liberal dating of Daniel, you would have to admit major fulfillments of prophecies, and therefore there is no reason to doubt the 530 BC date, especially when the Aramaic of Daniel is more in agreement with the traditional date of the book of Daniel. Now, just from what little we covered in Old Testament reliability, you can see why I didn't want to. I mean, this is just an overview of these, eight or nine books that we covered. If we had tried to cover all 39 books, you know, we could have been here forever. But I just want us to get the idea, and by the way, the Old Testament reliability is so much harder to argue for than New Testament reliability because the fact that a lot of the older copies were destroyed, were burnt when newer copies were made. When we go to the reliability of the New Testament manuscript, a good portion of the evidence will be the over 26,000 manuscript copies, ancient manuscript copies of the New Testament still in existence today, which you would not have for the Old Testament. That's Old Testament reliability. If you guys don't have any questions, we'll close this lecture out and call it an early night.